The Guardian.
This is Politics Weekly. I'm Rowena Mason. Theresa May is in China this week selling her vision of post-Brexit Britain, while back home the government's own leaked analysis shows a bleak outlook on whatever deal it gets, if it gets one at all. But does the government accept its own analysis? It depends who you ask.
Mr. Speaker, no, I am not able to name an accurate forecast, and I think that they are always wrong and wrong for good reasons.
As Tory divisions on Europe widen, we'll hear from John Penrose, a Conservative MP, on the party's Brexit fault lines.
For people like myself who voted Remain, we all thought the economy was going to go to hell in a handcart within weeks of any vote to leave, and it didn't. And the people on the Leave side said, no, it's going to be much better than that, but there are going to be all sorts of other things that should happen, which haven't yet, at least.
Plus, the Palace of Westminster is falling down and MPs are moving out. And the coming together of the anti-Brexit tribes could be about to happen. Chuka Umunna unveils a pro-EU supergroup pushing for voters to have a say on the final deal.
With our group, the key thing is it's like a bridge, if you like, between all the technical debate in Parliament and the activity on the ground, on the street, on the road, in your local community, in the country.
But first, Britain's economy will be significantly worse off in every scenario considered in a leaked government document modelling different types of Brexit. Parts of the civil service analysis leaked out this week, and the government effectively conceded to a vote calling for the whole thing to be made public amid claims that it was hiding the true impact of Brexit. A further leak showed that tightening UK immigration rules would do further damage to the economy, perfectly timed just as Theresa May warns today that EU migrants would face tougher restrictions during the Brexit transition phase. Now, Raf, it led to strange scenes in the Commons with government ministers rubbishing the government analysis this week. Talk us through exactly what happened.
Well, you had this extraordinary situation. Well, it was worth going back a couple of stages because remember the question of how much work the government has done to consider the impact of Brexit is itself a sort of an early chapter of the farce because of, you know, there was the original assertion that there were detailed, eye-wateringly detailed analyses. Then David Davis told the Select Committee that, in fact, on the other hand, maybe there weren't. Then separately, and there was always a suspicion that at least clearly the Treasury would have done some kind of economic account of what would happen, what would be the consequences of leaving the European Union. And then we were led to believe over the weekend, we understood that there was a document and it was being shown to ministers on a one-on-one basis because no one wanted it to leak and it was all terribly hush-hush. But therefore, by definition, this was a serious, proper thing that the government believed in, had some credibility because it was sort of circulating or would be circulating at cabinet level. Then as soon as it leaked, Steve Baker, the Brexit minister, came out and said, well, essentially, you can't believe anything these economists and these forecasters say. It's all rubbish and or it's sort of saboteur civil servants who are basically trying to undermine the government. So you had this, I think, quite preposterous situation where a minister of the government was essentially saying another part of the government is using government analysis to undermine the government. And then that, of course, forced Number 10 to then clarify whether the government agreed that the government thought the government was using government analysis to undermine the government. And at first it seemed that they did, and then it seemed that they didn't. So, you know, quite clearly, it's deeply embarrassing. But on the other hand, it's the sort of thing that people who already thought Britain shouldn't leave the European Union get extremely excited about, and people who still think Britain should leave the European Union just see as a reiteration of Project Fear and would brush it aside. So I don't think it changes a lot in that sense.
It was quite Kafkaesque, the whole process. But Katie, do you think it's healthier to have all this out in the open, or does it prevent the civil service from being candid with ministers to have leaks like this?
Well, I think leaks in general obviously aren't good for the government because it creates mistrust. And I also think there's a feeling amongst definitely the Brexit wing of the government that the civil service are against them. And I'm not saying that's particularly fair, but I think this will fuel that assertion because this is a targeted leak to a publication that isn't particularly pro-Brexit and has kind of been used to undermine the case. But I think as Raf has said, ultimately, I don't think this document's going to change that many minds because the Remainers will say, oh, look, you know, you're going to be economically worse. But ultimately, it was slightly more positive than the one that was put out before the referendum. I think maybe the WTO tariff was a bit worse, that prediction. But overall, it was better. So others will say that's good news. And they just don't believe these forecasts, many on the Brexit side, because you look at the predictions before and we would be in a recession right now is one of the options. And that hasn't happened.
Larry, you've made the economic case for Brexit on our pages very much against the grain. What do you make of this new analysis, and is it actually very new?
I think it's more politically significant than economically significant. I think that, you know, three things about the economics of it. One, it tells you what they think GDP would be like in 12 years' time. GDP is not a particularly good measure of how well the economy is doing. The much better measure is GDP per head. So you can grow the economy just through population growth. That doesn't really mean very much. That's the first point. The second point is that it uses some, if it's based on the same methodology as the pre-referendum document from the Treasury, it's based on some pretty implausible assumptions. Like just one, for example, is that all the extra trade we did with the EU after 1973 would disappear and we would get no benefit from breaking into other markets, which seems a pretty unlikely scenario. So that's the second. And the third point is one that Katie's just made, which is that, come on, you know, this is the Treasury or somebody forecasting 12 years ahead. Before the referendum, the Treasury said that the economy would go into a year-long recession, that unemployment would go up by 500,000. We've had not one quarter of negative growth. The economy grew by as much in 2017. Not a great year, 2017, but it was just as good as 2016. Unemployment's 200,000 lower. I mean, the idea that these people can forecast that far ahead using implausible assumptions is frankly for the birds. I think that why I say it's more political, clearly the government is, or someone inside the government is softening politics up for a softer Brexit. That's clearly where the government is going, because it can't get a hard Brexit or a clean Brexit through the Commons. I mean, that is the reality of it. I mean, and quite a lot of government people that I speak to just say, look, we want to have as close a relationship with the European Union as we possibly can. And even if we didn't, we couldn't possibly get anything harder through. We just haven't got the numbers.
It's worth adding also, sorry, that one of the other lines of defence that the government brought to this, or that Number 10 specifically brought to this, was that the analysis only looked at sort of off-the-peg scenarios, so sort of a Norwegian-type model or a Canadian-type model or a WTO rules-type model, and therefore wasn't looking at the extraordinary sort of technicolour dream coat version of Brexit that we will get under the bespoke deal that Theresa May wants to negotiate, and therefore, you know, isn't relevant because we'll get our cake and eat it. And the problem with that, obviously, is that's routinely the other EU27 say either you need to tell us a little bit more about what this actually means or you can't have it. And so, you know, ultimately, this just increases the pressure on Theresa May that, you know, we're feeling day in, day out, to just be now much more specific about what she means when she says
the government's getting a lot of pressure. Certainly economic ministers are getting a lot of pressure from business, CBI, all those sort of bodies, to actually remain in some form of customs union with the EU. When I was in Davos last week talking to business people, they said, you know, a customs union, the existing customs union, actually does quite a lot of good things. It avoids a hard border in Ireland. It actually prevents there being massive lorry parks on the M20 down towards Dover, and it prevents all the sort of, you know, bad supply chain problems that which business has talked about. And really what you're giving up in order to stay in a customs union is the ability to do your own trade deals. And that's what the big loss would be for the Brexiteers. And what the CBI says is that the government should be looking at that as a, you know, just as a straight spreadsheet issue, cost benefit. What are the costs of actually not being in a customs union against the benefits of being able to negotiate your own trade deals? And CBI position, and I suspect the position of a lot of people inside the Treasury and other departments, is that the benefits of being in a customs union far outweigh the benefits of being able to do your own trade deals.
Katie, is that something that the Brexiteers could swallow?
No. I think free trade and this idea of going out and forging your own trade deals is one that people will not be happy to give away. And actually, I mean, Jacob Rees-Mogg is not a compromising Brexiteer. He is now in charge of the European Research Group, so is more powerful. But in general, you have quite a large group of more pragmatic Brexiteers. Some of them are in government, so they can't speak their right mind right now, but people like Dominic Raab, even Steve Baker to some extent. And I think there are some things they can deal with. They can deal with a transition period where perhaps you are, you know, you can't make the rules and you're a rule taker. But this idea that they couldn't actually go and forge deals, I think, would defeat the point of Brexit for many.
So how has this leaked document gone down in the Conservative Party? Earlier, I spoke to John Penrose, who is another member of the party's influential European research group, but who voted Remain. I asked him what he made of these leaks.
Well, I'm also one of the other hats I wear is as I'm the government's anti-corruption champion, which is heavily to do with transparency. So I'm not going to sit here and say that transparency is a bad thing. But the important thing to remember about this document or these documents is that they are apparently, we're told, not yet completed drafts. And what they don't include in the analysis of the different options is actually the option which we are trying to achieve, which is this sort of, you know, tailor-made, bespoke free trade agreement. So it looks at all the other options, which are kind of the pre-baked ones, the Canada Plus and the Swiss model and all these other bits and pieces. And it's concluded that none of them are brilliant, but that's okay because that's not actually what we're aiming for. So step one is, you know, let's wait and see what if a completed version comes out with what a bespoke free trade agreement would do, and I would hope that those figures would be better. But also, one of the things which there is a wearying familiarity, I think, for people on all sides of the Brexit debate, whether or not you voted Remain or Leave, whether or not you are Conservative or Labour or something else, and certainly I suspect for your colleague Rowena in the journalist profession too, is that actually all the projections, all the economic projections have turned out to be wrong on both sides. I mean, it's actually truly embarrassing for the economists and really rather distressing for those of us on both sides who relied on it. So, you know, for people like myself who voted Remain, we all thought the economy was going to go to hell in a handcart within weeks of any vote to leave, and it didn't. And the people on the Leave side said, no, it's going to be much better than that, but there are going to be all sorts of other things which will happen, which haven't yet, at least. And so I think everybody is taking projections with a fairly hefty pinch of salt, whether or not we're right to, just because the projections in the past were wrong, whether or not they'll be wrong again, who knows? But there is a certain amount of sort of weary cynicism, I'm afraid. And I suspect, perish the thought that I should suggest that that journalists might be cynical about anything at all, of course. But I suspect that you guys are probably viewing this with a fairly hefty, thick lens that you're looking at it with as well.
Should we at least have tried, though, to have a best shot at what the economic and impact of Brexit is going to be in our desired scenario, which is this bespoke trade deal?
Yes, I think the government has said that that these things are a draft, so I imagine that part of the reason they're not yet complete is that that's still to be done. The difficulty, of course, of doing a bespoke version of a trade deal is you don't know what you're going to achieve. You know, it requires not just us to ask for it, but also for the EU27 to agree to it. And so therefore, if we did it on the basis of what we're asking for, it might look great, but we might not achieve all of that because the EU27 might agree to some of it and not the rest. And so therefore, that would be a bit of a theoretical rather than a practical outcome. When we know what it is and we've got it cleared up and you know, the negotiations are much further along, then yes, I should expect they will need to do that. And that's one of the things which certainly people will be debating and asking questions about when we get to the substantive vote nearer the time. That will be, I'm sure, you will be asking that question, I will be asking that question, everyone will want to know. And at that point, it will be important to come up with the best answers. I'm willing to bet you, though, that there will be as many different economic answers as there are economists. So whether or not we'll be any clearer by then, I don't know. But at least we'll have more information.
John Penrose there. Well, John didn't want to get into any discussion of his party's leadership, but behind the scenes, Conservative MPs are growing increasingly restless with Theresa May. One report today suggests that an unnamed senior minister is on the verge of coming out publicly against the Prime Minister. And Katie, on the front of your magazine today, The Spectator, is a stark cartoon image of Theresa May and the headline, Lead or Go. What is more likely, do you think?
I've had a few people speak to me about cover and be like, are you calling on her to go? And we're like, well, she does have two options. But many are quick to, and even Conservative MPs are pointing out that the first option might not be something she can actually do. And that is that maybe she isn't someone who can lead. I still think the problem that Conservative MPs have is they are really in despair at the moment at their leader, at the current situation. Whether you remain or leave, you accept that this drift and indecision on Brexit is damaging. But the alternative is still very scary, and it would be a very unpredictable bloodbath leadership election. No one knows where it would end up. But the problem is, every day that this goes on, people begin to think, could it really be worse? Should we just take a chance on that?
Raf, do you think it would actually be that bloody, or could they go for a bloodless coup where some of the senior cabinet ministers got together and knocked some heads together and decided who was going to take over?
I suppose, I mean, the lesson from politics for the last 2 years is sort of anything is possible. Look, the structural underlying problem here is Brexit. It's just a ferociously difficult thing to do. It's almost impossible. I would say it is impossible to do it in terms that will satisfy everyone who supported it, because people supported it for such a wide variety of reasons. So you have this sort of situation where, and Theresa May presented herself very effectively as the sort of safe pair of hands, the Remainer, who would also be a very comfortable leaver. Brexit means Brexit. She was like the sort of the responsible schoolmarmish teacher who comes into the unruly classroom and everyone fell into place. And that seemed to work for the Conservative Party for a while. But essentially what they've done is they've said to her, you need to deliver us this great herds of unicorns kind of galloping across the horizon from the great Brexit sunlit uplands. And guess what? There aren't any unicorns. And now they're saying, well, this unicorn herd is really disappointing. Where are our unicorns? Well, that's a fundamental structural problem with Brexit. So what I find extraordinary, however, is that you're one of the compromise positions that's now around is this idea that she could just sort of stay on until March the 29th, 2019, sort of deliver Brexit, but then go, because then the Tories could move on and do something else, which when you stop to think about it is insane. What they're saying is she's rubbish, she's useless, we don't want her to lead us, but we do need her to do the single most important thing any government has done since the Second World War. In other words, she's not good enough for us, but she's good enough for you people. She can do your slightly bodged, crappy Brexit, but then we want a proper leader. I mean, it's madness, really, what's going on. And yet, one of the rules of politics is just when you think it can't possibly carry on like this, it does.
I mean, it's kind of interesting, isn't it, that Brexit is just dominating everything. I mean, you know, it's just sucking the life out of any other policy area. That strikes me. I mean, just before Christmas had come, brought out quite an interesting industrial strategy white paper about which there's been absolutely no follow through at all. You know, there's been the government seems to be completely paralysed. I mean, one of the good things about Brexit, I thought, was that it did actually expose some of Britain's deep-seated economic problems, and the industrial strategy was supposed to be a response to that and start putting it right. But the problem is that the government seems to be so paralysed by the Brexit process that it doesn't have the managerial time or the political will to actually do anything other than try and sort out its own internal divisions, which is a pretty sad place to be.
So has the job just been too big for her?
Yeah, I think it has. I mean, I actually think she's quite a limited politician. I mean, that's my impression of her. She doesn't really have a big vision. She doesn't really, you know, she kept very quiet during the referendum process. She was Remainer, but you'd never really have known it. That's one of the reasons she got the job. And all her weaknesses have been exposed as Prime Minister.
I don't think it's just Brexit. I think actually the point where this really turned against her, I mean, 3 weeks ago when she just returned from the Christmas holidays, then lots of us were saying she looks in her strongest position since that disastrous snap election. She's able to carry out a reshuffle. We've seen that she was able to move around words and job titles more than people. But the real problem is the pause in the Brexit negotiations, which just exposed this total lack of domestic agenda. And actually, if you look at the Conservative Party, people like to depict it as this group of, you know, people obsessed with Europe, and they are definitely on both sides. But there's this big group in the middle, which is much more the stop banging on about Europe group. And that's much more people like Nick Bowles, Nicholas Soames. And the reason they've come forward and started complaining is because on issues like housing, issues on education, there is nothing happening. And that, I think, is just as much as last straw on the camel's back than the Brexit position.
I think that's right. And it's worth pointing out in this particular context that she doesn't have a majority in Parliament. I mean, she's got the DUP, but that's a very specific Brexit thing. And so education is a great example. I mean, you know, Theresa May very sincerely believes that her time as Prime Minister might be remembered one day about something other than Brexit, which I think is naive, but she's quite sincere about it. And one of her big personal crusades is advancing social mobility, for which education is a key plank. But the problem is she thought the mechanism for that was selection at secondary level and expanding grammar schools. Now, I think she's wrong, but she's entitled to her view. But the point is there isn't a majority in the House of Commons to do that. So it had to fall out of the manifesto. So there is literally no flagship education policy. And yet she sincerely believes that education will be one of her great missions.
Well, the Prime Minister is in China this week attempting to sell her post-Brexit vision of a global trading nation to potentially the world's biggest market. Jessica Elgott is there with her and joins me now. So, Jess, can you tell us how Theresa May is doing out in China? Does it look like it's going to be a successful trip?
Yeah, and I think this is her first bilateral visit to China. She's been here before as part of the G20 delegation, but not on her own. So she really needed this to be a kind of success, and she needed to project an image of a successful prime minister on the world stage. I mean, there's been some limited kind of announcements so far, although I think we'll hear more about what she's secured and what the businesses that she's brought along secured tomorrow when she addresses the Shanghai Business Forum. But today she's been meeting with President Xi. They've had a tea ceremony, and she's talked about, you know, the two countries' growing trade links. They've set up a kind of strategic group to explore new ways of expanding trade. That's not necessarily about crushing out a trade deal. It's about, you know, how do you increase trade between the two countries within the parameters we've got now. It's pretty baby steps, but number 10 certainly seems pleased with that. The only kind of sticking point has been was yesterday when she met Premier Li. There was certainly some differences over this big Chinese infrastructure project called the Belt and Road Initiative, which the Chinese are very keen to get to sort of sign a formal endorsement. No Western country has done that yet. Germany and France, Australia, have declined to sign it because they're a bit concerned about the political implications of it. The political implications are basically that this huge infrastructure project, which will expand the neighbouring countries, is all aimed at getting Chinese contractors into building projects in neighbouring countries, and this is bringing those countries really close into Beijing's orbit and increasing China's influence in the region. So they've got concerns about it. May said in her press conference with Li yesterday that, you know, the UK was a natural partner for Belt and Road. They could offer expertise, but, you know, she didn't go much further than that and said, you know, they were still exploring ways they could work together, which is a delicate way of saying Britain doesn't really want to sign this memorandum of understanding that China wanted us to sign. So apart from that, I mean, it's been quite standard shaking hands. May's visited the Forbidden City, held a reception at the embassy. And, you know, I think that she really needs to project a strong image.
Do you think that China's really that interested in the UK? Because David Cameron and George Osborne kept going on about how they wanted a golden era of trade between the two countries. But then last year, it seemed like Theresa May's visit to China was bumped in favour of one from Donald Trump.
Yes, that's what we heard last year. And May has been repeated the phrase golden era. She's a few times she said that we need to intensify the golden era without really expanding too much on what that might mean, apart from just increasing trade between the two countries. It is quite interesting so far that there haven't been huge deals to announce. I don't think that, you know, and commentators have been saying, you know, like, how interested are the Chinese in Britain at the moment? There was an announcement yesterday where they said that they had agreed to expand the importing of British agricultural goods, including expanding minimum dairy products, and also considering lifting the ban on British beef, which has been there since the BSE crisis. That's promising. That in his remarks, as he talked about that, Premier Li was saying, well, you know, obviously China's self-sufficient in food products, but, you know, we just think it's nice to give everyone a choice. And so it's always this kind of underlining of British products are nice, and I'm sure that we can have more of them, but, you know, it's not saying these products are essential to China.
One thing about these trips abroad with the Prime Minister is that you get to see her a bit more up close and personal. You're on her private plane with her. And this is coming at a time when there are lots of rumblings about her leadership. How is she looking? And does she look rattled by what's going on back at home, her problems over Brexit and her domestic agenda?
Yes, she spoke to reporters when we were on her plane, the IS Voyager, flying into Wuhan overnight. And she seemed pretty defiant, actually. A Prime Minister really wants to face and her critics, she says he wasn't a quitter. She stressed a couple of times in the next elections in 2022, and she kept saying she had a job to do, but she was pressed a bit by reporters saying, you know, your Conservative colleagues are calling for bold ideas, and she kept saying she had bold ideas. The ones she came up with were things, she was kind of pressing names, some of them, and the ones she came up with were, well, you know, we've seen some GDP growth, and we've seen the attainment gap between rich and poor students narrowing, you know. I'm not sure that that's what her colleagues are talking about, but it's those kind of everyday incremental improvements that kind of thing that she wants to stress. she says that, you know, there's been some bold pledges on housing, but, you know, the housing white paper, a lot of people do criticise that for not going far enough as well. So she, that her sort of stock phrases that she's getting on with the job, that's what she wants to keep stressing, that's what she thinks that the British people want. But, you know, that more and more it seems like just getting on with the job and not providing a kind of bold vision isn't what her Conservative colleagues want.
And this statement that she's made about immigration during the transition period, that she thinks that the rules should change for new EU migrants coming over after March 2019, did that appear to come out of nowhere? How did that statement come about?
That was something that we asked her about, and that's why we sort of gave a response. She said, we said, this is a kind of clear point of difference between you and Brussels, and is there a compromise to be made? And again, you know, she quite carefully phrased, she didn't completely rule out a compromise, but she says, here's the reason why we don't think it's the same scenario, that persons who have been living in the UK before Brexit, they made their life here before they knew Brexit was a possibility. If you come in the transition period, you know Brexit's a possibility. It's not the same scenario. But, you know, the EU will say, well, then you've got sort of two tiers of EU citizens having different rights, and don't think that's acceptable. She's clearly decided that this is a red line for her, although she didn't use that phrase, I think possibly because she knows that she may have to do a kind of compromise on it if she wants to get a deal on transition done quickly. But, you know, it's hard to say whether she'll compromise, but she has put herself in a bit on this, and it could be, you know, potentially quite embarrassing if she doesn't need to worry about it.
Jessica L got there. Now, Larry, Prime Ministers have been increasingly cosying up to China in recent years, but May's first move as Prime Minister was to put Hinkley Point, the nuclear power station with Chinese involvement, on hold, which didn't go down at all well in Beijing, did it?
It didn't, although she eventually did give it the go-ahead. I mean, I think that what we've found in the Prime Minister's visit to China is the difficulty in sucking up to large numbers of foreign governments at the same time. So last week she was in Davos sucking up to Trump and giving him a promise of a state visit. So Trump is very dubious about the big Belt and Road project, which is the big thing for China to sort of, you know, girdle the world with Chinese influence, and the Americans are very dubious about that. So May has gone to China and not been particularly friendly towards it, and not certainly not as friendly as the Chinese would have wanted them to be. So I mean, I think that generally the visit highlights the problem. Two problems. One is, you know, you can't actually please all your foreign friends at once. The second deeper problem is, does it actually do anything for your trade? I mean, it's a sort of rather sort of naive view in government, I think, that, you know, you can go somewhere and, you know, you can negotiate a trade deal with China, or you negotiate a trade deal with India, and that will actually solve Britain's problems, which seems to me to always to be putting the cart before the horse. You know, you export because you have an economy that works. You know, you don't get an economy that works because you export. It's a bit like saying that I could become a great scientist if I was, you know, given a place at the Royal Society. You know, it's not that way round. You know, you know, you are a good scientist, therefore you get a place at the Royal Society. So I think that's what we know about Britain's trade is already that we export things that we're good at, like services. Even though there aren't that many trade deals involving services around the world, we have a very good service sector, which is very competitive. We don't do very well at goods, even though there are very few tariffs on goods anywhere in the world anymore. And that's because our industrial base is not very good. So I think that, you know, I'm always a bit dubious about these foreign trade missions, what they actually deliver. What they really deliver in the short term is the Prime Minister can get out of the country and avoid some of her domestic problems.
Well, meanwhile, back in London, MPs voted to move out of the Houses of Parliament for vital repairs that could take more than a decade. Raph, where should they go in the meantime?
I quite liked the giant Perspex bubble on the Thames, of which I think illustrations are available online. I also quite like the idea, you know, that a parliament, etymologically, is the collection of people speaking. So it doesn't actually, you know, the parliament exists by virtue of the members getting together with the speaker and following the conventions. So it doesn't actually need a building. So you could actually sort of move around. You could have a sort of a roving caravan, nomadic parliament. The practical reality is, especially given that ministers have to are also MPs and have to be questioned by Parliament and shuttle between their departments and common sessions. Obviously, it has to be in downtown SW1 somewhere. Yeah, that's just that ends up being the geographical fact of the situation. But I'm quite looking forward to the idea of sessions in Parliament outside the sort of Pugin buildings, not because I don't like the traditions and the customs and the pantomime of it, I actually do, but I just think it'll be very interesting seeing how well that stuff, the weird arcane language and the protocols, survive in a more modern setting. It will suddenly look very peculiar, the forms of address and the methods and the men in tights and all that, when you're not surrounded by, on that particular stage. So that's going to be fascinating.
Katie, is there an argument that the whole place is just unsuitable for running a modern democracy and the time's just right to build something a bit more modern, maybe somewhere more modern?
It's not an argument I would make. I mean, there's lots of arguments you hear now and then, isn't it, that we should stop being in the bubble and we should leave London and put Parliament, somewhere else, perhaps Manchester. But saying that, obviously, at PMQs this week, we had a robin enter the chamber and flying around. And clearly there is a lot of work that needs to be done. I was sat next to a Lord, I think, on Tuesday, who was complaining basically about the foul smell in the toilets in the House of Lords, to the extent that he now leaves the premises. If he needs to go to the bathroom, he'll just leave Parliament and go somewhere else, and maybe a prep. But so I think it's good it's being done, but we do definitely need to return to it.
Larry, what do you think? Knock it all down?
I'm actually in favour of moving Parliament in the longer term somewhere else other than London. I think that one of the problems with the British economy generally is that everything, media, finance, politics, is so concentrated in London, and that doesn't tend to happen in a lot of other countries, which often, look at Germany, the media is not based in Berlin, and the industry is not, Berlin is not the centre of everything in Germany. Similarly in the US, Washington DC is the government capital, but it's not the capital of everything. And I think the problem with the UK is that everything is so centralised in London, and there's a limit to what you can actually do as a government. But one of the things you could do is move the government. And the success of the BBC in moving large chunks of its staff to Salford, and then the impact that's had on regeneration of Manchester has been quite considerable. So I think in the longer term, I would be definitely giving thought to moving Parliament out of.
Wouldn't you then also have to move Whitehall?
Because you probably would. Yeah. You probably would. But I don't see, I don't see a problem in that really. You could set up a new government city if you wanted to.
Yeah, Birmingham.
And why not? One of the justifications for HS2, such as there are, is that it's actually going to make Britain a more connected place and enable people to get from the Midlands and the North to London much more quickly. So, a great regeneration project would be to move Parliament out of and government out of London. London would still be a great, great city. It would still have the city, it would still have advertising, still have all their business services, still have the media. But you would actually set up an alternative centre, which would be great for the economies of other regions. And that is the real issue with the UK economy, is that everything is dominated by London and the South East. It's a massive difference between economic performance in this part of the world and the rest of the country.
Well, you can follow all this and the rest of this week's political news at theguardian.com/politics. Now, the year and a half following the Brexit referendum has seen politics in an almost constant flux and parties' fortunes dramatically changing. But in the midst of it all, across party groups battling against a hard Brexit and sometimes each other. But this week they've agreed to put aside their minor differences and join forces against a common enemy, calling for the British people to have a meaningful voice in the final Brexit deal if Theresa May comes back with one. I sat down with one of the movement's leading figures, the Labour MP Chuka Umunna, who is just announcing that he is bringing all these groups together.
So, Chuka, you seem to have achieved the impossible and got all the groups who are campaigning against a hard Brexit together on the same page under the same umbrella. How did you manage to do that?
Well, it's been a joint effort. And part of the challenge with the pro-European movement, as it were, is that there are different shades of opinion, just as there is on the Brexit side. You have some, Brextremists, if you like, and then you have moderate Brexiters who would entertain things like, leaving but staying in the single market. our challenge in the pro-European movement was bringing those people who don't want to see Brexit happen at all together with those who accept it, you know, it may happen and want a soft Brexit. What unites everybody is that they want the people in some way, shape or form to have a say on the form of Brexit. You could argue that there was a mandate from the 2016 referendum for us to leave the European Union. A majority of people who participated in that poll voted that way. But what we don't know, and you know, the thing for which there was no mandate, was how we leave the European Union and the form of Brexit that we end up with. And all of the groups are united in their determination that the people have got to have a place at the table in this process, and it shouldn't just be dictated to by a ministerial elite in Westminster. And in fact, the strength of the aggregate of the organisations is that we have a massive grassroots network, which I don't believe is matched by those arguing for Brexit or an extreme Brexit. I mean, if you look at the followership of the different organisations involved, you know, Open Britain, which is by far the biggest, has over 500,000 people following it and engaging with its activities. But then you've got the Scientists for EU and the Healthier In campaign. You know, that's 250,000 people who are involved with those different organisations. Leave Watch, you have a number of people doing, you know, sharing graphics and arguments online. You have many of the European movement. You may have seen many of their market stalls and street campaigning activity. So there is this huge network in the country, and this brings it together with the network of parliamentarians who've been working cross-party in Parliament to make sure that we got the meaningful vote, for example, before Christmas.
The leadership of the anti-Brexit movement, or the anti-hard Brexit movement, you're obviously leading this umbrella group, but who are the other names that you need to have on side in order to persuade people that the path that we're going down at the moment is not right?
Well, without pointing to specific individuals, I mean, with our group, the key thing is it's like a bridge, if you like, between all the technical debate in Parliament and the activity on the ground, on the street, on the road, in your local community, in the country. And one of the reasons we were successful before Christmas is because it was such a cross-party effort. And so, you know, you had organisers in Anna Soubry, Dominic Grieve, and some of their other colleagues in the Conservative Party who were ensuring that they had a voice, and they'd been felt kind of, some of them, I think, not those individuals specifically, had felt that they'd been ignored, if you like. And then in the Labour Party, you have the likes of Heidi Alexander, Alison McGovern, who lead the Labour campaign for the single market, Stephen Doughty and Chris Leslie, who, you know, have been quite instrumental in helping to organise amendments, etc. And then, of course, Caroline Lucas from the Green Party, who's an important figure on the left, and the Liberal Democrats, who have a certain constituency. And what the all-party parliamentary group on EU relations has done is really brought them all together. And so these are definitely going to be key figures as we go forward that represent all parts of the country. You know, Alison represents a Merseyside seat, for example. Anna Soubry represents a Midlands seat. And in addition to Wales and Scotland, well represented too. And I think the exciting thing actually is you've kind of got a new leadership, if you like. It's not about me personally, but there's a group of us. And we weren't the leading figures in the Britain Stronger in Europe campaign. We are a new generation. And I mean that not necessarily by reference to age, but we're figures who have not, relatively speaking, been in politics for that long compared to, you know, some long-standing members of the House of Parliament. So it's bringing that together with the doctors and the clinicians in Scientists for Your EU and Healthier in EU and the local teacher, the vicar and others who are part of the different European movement and Open Britain networks on the ground. It's marrying together those two things.
Chukramana there. Well, that is all we have time for this week. Leave your thoughts on any of this on our podcast page. My thanks to Larry Elliott, Katie Balls and Raphael Bear. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Rowena Mason. Thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.